Thank you, Alex. So, first of all, I'd like to thank Matt, Ruth, and Silke for organising this nice conference, and of course, Perimeter for hosting. And I was going to start by saying that I'm sorry if I get a bit flustered. I just arrived last night, have a bit of jet lag, and then woke up to becoming the first speaker on this morning. However, Ruth just told me that she was in exactly the same position yesterday with less sleep, so I'm not allowed to give that disclaimer, so this is me not giving that disclaimer there. So I'm going to be talking about stability of quantized vortices and two-component condensates. So this is based on some work that I've been doing over the last few years within the consortium with various members. And the new results are in this new paper that's on the archive, which has been recently published at the beginning of this year. So I'm going to start by giving some motivation as to why I think this problem is interesting. I'm going to start mainly by talking about what happens in the case of a one-component condensate, because there we can really analyze the physics behind this, this vortex stability problem and get some intuition for what's going on. And in particular, this is, of course, an analog gravity conference, so what I'm going to do is show you how you can understand this vortex instability from the perspective of black hole superradiance. Once we've got this nice intuition as to why this instability happens, we can look at the case of a two-component condensates, where it turns out that this you can actually stabilize this vortex decay by putting a second component in your system. And I'll then briefly conclude with some outlook about why I think this is interesting for future studies. So skipping forward a little bit, this is the end result that I want to try describe in this talk. So the kind of system that I'm talking about in this presentation is we've got a circularly symmetric kind of trapping potential here, within which we've got a condensate. And in the center of this circular trap, we place the vortex in the center. Now, it's well known that if the vortex has a larger quantum number than one, and then the system is prone to split up into a cluster of smaller vortices. So in this simulation on the left-hand side, what we have is a doubly quantized vortex in the center with a quantum charge of 2. And what this does is it wants to split up into two neighboring vortices. And it wants to do this because this is the energetically stable configuration for the system. Now, it turns out that if you add a second component into the core of the vortex, then it actually becomes energetically unfavorable for this splitting to happen. So what this means is that by putting some atoms of a second species inside your vortex core, you can not only prevent this decay, but if you try to split up the vortices, which is what this second simulation is showing, if you try to split these vortices, then dissipation will actually want to drive them back together again, because having two separate vortices in this system is energetically unfavorable, so dissipation wants to force them back together again. So everything that I'm going to talk about in this talk is going to go into understanding what's happening in these two simulations here. If I point, does that move my pointer? I'm just going to do that instead. Okay, so here's a very brief, so we've already done that, so coming on to the motivation. So there's actually a lot of motivation for this problem coming from the purely condensed matter side of things. And the overarching theme here is that the dynamics of quantum fluids is intrinsically linked to the vortices that live within them. So a very celebrated example of this is the Berezinski-Kostolits-Thouless phase transition, which is where you have binding and unbinding of vortex-anti-vortex pairs. And the discovery of this phenomenon was enough to win Kostolits and Thouless the 2016 Nobel Prize. And vortices also play an important role in quantum turbulence. So quantum turbulence is characterized by a chaotic tangle of, or a disordered tangle, I should say, of quantum vortices. So understanding how this happens in a quantum system can provide us with some nice insights into the generic problem of turbulence. Now, it's also been suggested that one could image the motion of vortices through a condensate by seeding the vortex cores with atoms of a second species. And what we found at the beginning of this project is that if the atoms that you put inside the vortex cores are themselves a second condensate, then this actually affects the stability properties of the system. So for anyone wanting to image vortices in their system with a second condensate, It's important, as I'm going to show here, that to know that this will actually affect the stability properties of the system. But of course, this is an analog gravity conference, so we should state some analog gravity motivation. So the main thing I think that this is interesting for is the quantum black hole project, where there we have essentially a cylinder of superfluid helium within which we place a draining vortex, and this simulates aspects of rotating black holes, as we're going to hear about later in this conference. Now, it's well known that superfluid helium is a two-fluid system consisting of the superfluid component and the normal fluid, but it's a notorious problem that it's hard to derive a model of this from first principles. So everything that I'm going to talk about here, we can kind of think of as a prototypical model for a microscopic description of these vortices, upon which we can then build more sophisticated models later. And finally, I'm also going to show you in this talk how... Is everything okay? Oh, is this one better? Okay. Oh, that's so much better. Thank you. Okay. Yeah, I'm going to show you later in this talk how this vortex decay can be understood from a black hole superradiance perspective. So if we actually want to study black hole superradiance phenomenology within our condensed matter systems, then one way we can do this is by looking at vortex decay. So let's actually get on to what systems we're talking about. So we're thinking about quite a basic model here. It's just a system of, it's just a Bose gas, which is cooled close to zero temperature. And it's well known that a good description of this gas can be given by the Gross-Potefsky equation. So this is an equation which looks like the Schrödinger equation, but we have this extra nonlinear term on the end here. We've got the usual kinetic term, the potential term, which is containing our, this is describing our circularly symmetric trapping potential. This is an equation for the condensate order parameter, which is this psi here. And this last term here encodes the interactions between the bosons and the system. So this G here is the interaction parameter, and if G is positive, then we have repulsive interactions. It's well known that this system can be viewed as an effective fluid, and we can see this by introducing this Madelung representation here, where this, this N is the number density of atoms in the condensate. So this is describing the distribution of bosons through the system. This mu here is just the chemical potential, and if we take the gradient of this phase here, then we obtain the velocity field, which describes how the bosons are flowing around in the system. When we do this, we get two equations from our Gross-Potefsky equation. So we get the Bernoulli equation. It looks like the Bernoulli equation, but we have this extra quantum pressure term here. And then the second equation we get is just a continuity equation for the number density, which is basically just a statement about mass conservation. We can also introduce this healing length here, which is a characteristic length scale in our problem. And we can find this by looking at the ratio of this kinetic term to this interaction term here. And this healing length gives the length scale over which the condensate heals back to its bulk value, which, for example, happens in the vortex core, but also at the walls of our that's containing our condensate. So now we're interested in studying fluctuations in our system. So the way that we can do this in the usual way is to perturb the fluid variables. And if we look at fluctuations which have a much longer wavelength than this healing length here, then this Bernoulli equation, we can drop the quantum pressure term from it and obtain a simple looking equation. And when we combine this with the continuity equation, we get a single wave equation for these phase fluctuations here. Where here I've introduced this the c squared term here, which is just the usual speed of sound. Now we get analog gravity because it turns out that this equation that we wrote down here for sound waves is mathematically equivalent to the Klein-Gordon equation, which gives the propagation of a massless scalar field through an effective spacetime. And in order to make this identification, we have to write down the effective metric that's seen by these sound waves in the following way. So if we're the usual analog gravity thing is that if we're clever about how we engineer our fluid flow, then we can in effect simulate different space-time scenarios. But in my talk, I'm interested in a very specific kind of background flow. So these are the usual just purely rotating vortex states, which are in condensed matter physics are just referred to as quantum vortices. So this is given by a velocity field which just has a component in the angular direction. And it scales as 1 over r. So here we've put the vortex in the center of our system. The velocity field is going to be slow, far away from the center of the vortex, and it's going to get faster and faster as we get into the center. And this L here is referred to as the winding number of the vortex. So because of constraints on the order parameter, because this has to be continuous, this L here has to be integer valued. And the integer valuedness of this L here is referred to as the quantization of the vortex. So for L equals 1, we have a singly quantized vortex. L equals 2 is a doubly quantized vortex, and so on for the higher winding numbers. In general, we can refer to those as multiply quantized vortices. And an acronym that you might see in this presentation is MQVs, which is multiply quantized vortices for short. You can visualize what's going on here by imagining that in the center of your... Oh, that's hard to click. There we go. So this is just a very ad hoc simulation of how you might envisage these bosons being convected around in your system. So the circle there is the trapping potential. The blue dots are supposed to represent the bosons, and these are convected around by the velocity field. So they're going to be moving slowly at the edge of the condensate. They're going to be going quite fast in the center here. And the reason that there's less atoms in the center is because when we solve for the density, then we get density profiles that look like the following functions here. So these asymptote to some constant values out in the bulk of the condensate, but in the core, they drop to zero. And this region where the density profile is approximately zero is referred to as the vortex core. So we can see here by looking at the vortex profiles for the different winding numbers that this core region is going to increase as we increase the winding number, which is essentially due to centrifugal effects. And then going back to our analog gravity on the previous slide, we can ask what was that question, Jörg?
So what's the unit of R in here? Is that in healing length or what is it? The unit of the radius.
We've done this a-dimensionalization at the top. So effectively by setting h, m, and mu equal to 1, you set the healing length to 1. So this is in units of the healing length. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. So we can ask what's the effective metric corresponding to our vortex state here. And we can see that something interesting happens because far away from the vortex axis, this velocity field component is going to go to zero, and this density is going to go to a constant. So this is going to be positive far outside the vortex core. But then as we approach this vortex core here, the density is going to zero, and this velocity squared term here is increasing. So this is going to turn negative. And when this turns negative, this is related to something well known in black hole physics called the ergosphere. And inside the ergosphere, it's possible for fluctuations to have negative energy densities. And these negative energy densities are going to play a very important role in our discussion of this vortex instability. Okay, so now that I've defined the background system that we're talking about here, what we're going to do is we're going to look at linear fluctuations of the system, analyze the normal modes, and see if we get some instabilities in the system. So the way that we can do this is by decomposing our phase fluctuations into the different azimuthal and frequency components. So this M here just gives the number of peaks that you would expect as you trace a circle around the vortex core. And for simplicity, let's focus on the case of the most simple multiply quantized vortex that you can have, which is L equals 2. And let's look at the M equals 2 modes within this system. So by solving the linear equations, we can find the corresponding eigenvalues of those equations, which is just the frequencies of the modes. And we can plot what these frequencies look like. So there's going to be a real part and an imaginary part. And we can see how this varies with as we increase the size of this circular trapping potential. So there's a lot going on in this plot. So let's break it down with a simple diagram. So on the right, we've got essentially our box-like potential in polar coordinates. So we've got the vortex axis on r equals 0. And we've got the trap boundary at rb. And we've got our background density profile, which is some constant out in the bulk, and then it drops to zero on the vortex axis. So when we solve for these normal modes, there's two distinct classes. The first ones that we get are these phonons, which live out in the bulk of the condensate. And as we increase the size of the trap, just like when you solve the Schrodinger equation and you increase the size of the box that you're solving in, all the eigenvalues get closer and closer together in energy or in frequency. So that's what these black lines are showing over here on the left-hand side. As we increase the trap radius, all of these phonon frequencies are getting closer together and decreasing the spacing between them. Now, there's a distinct second type of mode that we get when we do this solving, And we can refer to this as the vortex mode, because this is a mode which is strongly localized on the vortex axis. And importantly, the energy of this vortex mode is negative. So this is associated with a lowering of the overall energy of the system. And now when we increase the trap size, we can see that this vortex mode stays approximately constant in its frequency. And the reason for that is that when we increase the trap size, the vortex core is essentially not changing its properties. So because this mode lives in the vortex core, it doesn't change its frequency. But we can see that something interesting happens when this frequency crosses one of the phonon frequencies. And the reason for this is that at certain values of the trap size, we get a coupling between this vortex mode and one of the exterior phonons. So it turns out that this coupled mode now has zero total energy. And the interpretation of this is that the negative energy in the vortex core is being counterbalanced by the positive energy phonon. So physically what this is encoding is the excitation of the vortex mode at the expense of a phonon being produced out in the bulk of the condensate. And by investigating the imaginary part of the frequencies here, we can see that when we get this coupling, we get a non-zero imaginary part, and this positive imaginary part is going to be associated with exponentially growing modes. So these are going to be instabilities in the system. So these are going to grow in time. Eventually, they're going to enter the nonlinear regime. And we can now ask, by going back to our full gross Potevsky equation, what is the endpoint of that instability? So here's some simulations of the full GPE, which has been solved by a split-step Fourier method. And in the top left here, we've got this doubly quantized vortex, which is unstable in that M equals 2 mode, which is what the previous slide was showing. And we can see that this instability, this vortex core mode, is separating the two vortices in the center. And this is at the expense of the production of an M equals 2 phonon, if I could find the cursor. There we go. Oh, missed it. There we go. Yeah, so we can see that these vortices have separated in the center, and this has decreased the energy of the central configuration, and the excess energy has been output into one of these phonons in the bulk. And because there's two peaks here and two troughs, this is in the M equals 2 mode. We can play a similar game for the higher winding numbers. So here I've got a triply quantized vortex. This separates in either into a line, in which case the M equals 2 mode is unstable, or it can separate into a triangular lattice, in which case it's the M equals 3 mode that's unstable with three peaks outside. So in general, the mode which goes unstable in this normal mode plot determines the vortex configuration that you end up getting. Okay, so that's all just purely condensed matter physics, really. Let's actually now start talking about some analog gravity. So we can interpret the mechanism behind this instability by looking at another effect in black hole physics. There's a question? Yeah, Patrick.
Yeah, just if you go back to the simulations, how do you set up your initial conditions so you can actually get this splitting into, well, destabilizing M2 or M3?
Sure. Yeah, so actually here in these particular simulations, what I did was I just seeded with the mode which goes unstable, with a small amount of that mode. So at the beginning, you don't see it. Another way that you could do it is you could tune the trap size so that you're selecting the mode which is most unstable. So for a certain trap size, it would be, for example, perhaps the M equals 3 mode, which is most unstable, and not the M equals 2. So in that way, you could determine the configuration of vortices. So back to this black hole perspective, let's look at super radiance in the Kerr space-time. So the Kerr metric in natural units, where the speed of light, Newton's constant, are equal to 1, is this horrible mess. And super radiance happens for a whole range of fields, but the simplest one that it happens for is a massless scalar field. So that's just described by our Klein-Gordon equation. We can do the usual frequency and azimuthal splitting of this, and we can write an effective Schrodinger equation for the radial part of this field. Now, when we obtain this equation, we get this effective potential barrier here. And for a Kerr black hole, this looks like the following. So it goes to some constant at infinity, and it also goes to a different constant on the horizon. And when we're thinking about wave scattering with black holes, what we're doing is we're sending in something from infinity and asking, how does this reflect? So we can set up our scattering problem by sending an incident wave of amplitude I into the system. This is then going to reflect off our potential barrier with amplitude r, and because it's a wave, it can tunnel through this barrier here and be transmitted with amplitude t into the horizon. So that's just the usual kind of scattering problem. We can look at a conserved current for this equation that we wrote down. So the relevant conserved current is the Wronskian. And this gives us a relation between the different scattering coefficients. And we can see when this prefactor here goes negative, then this r squared term here is going to be bigger than this I squared term here. So physically what that means is the reflected wave has a larger amplitude than the incident wave. And for positive frequencies, this happens when the frequency is less than the azimuthal number multiplied by the rotational velocity of the black hole on its horizon. So when this is satisfied, we get this amplification, and this kind of amplification is known as rotational superradiance. So now what does this have to do with our vortex states? Well, it turns out that we can draw a very similar picture for those vortex states, except in the case of a vortex, we don't have a horizon. We now have a core where those ingoing waves can reflect. So now we replace this horizon with this vortex core, and these transmitted modes get reflected off the vortex axis. And what happens now is when these modes are outgoing, each time they reflect off this barrier here, their negative energy gets further amplified. And the physical reason this happens is because each time this amplification occurs on this side, positive energy is leaking out, out to infinity. So within this picture, we see that because we've now got this effective trapping region here, it's going to be possible to get trapped negative energy modes inside, which just continuously leak out positive energy to infinity. And this is precisely what this unstable vortex mode that was splitting up the vortex was. So within this picture, we see that this vortex mode, which is splitting up our vortex, is just a superradiant bound state which lives inside the vortex core, which makes a nice kind of contact with black hole physics. In a real experiment, we unfortunately don't have an infinite system because we don't have infinite funding, much as we would like to. And the effect of this is to now discretize this phonon spectrum. So by introducing a hard wall here, we now get an effective cavity within which we can trap modes on this side. And when we solve for the wavelengths which fit inside these two different regions, we get exactly the kind of thing that I drew on one of the previous slides, where we have the different phonons living outside the vortex core. And then this mode which fits in this region is this vortex core mode, which is causing the instability. Okay, so that's how it all works for a one component condensate. So now let's add a second component and see what happens, because this is where the new results are. So the kind of two component systems I'm considering are two equations which look like the GPE that we had before, except there's now one for component one and one for component two. But we've also got this interaction term between the two different species encoded by this G12 here. And we're taking all the interactions are going to be repulsive, so all of these interaction parameters are going to be positive here. So to make contact with experiment a bit, let's now put some names on these two different types of condensate. So we're going to call condensate one, which is the majority component, the component that we have the most of, we're going to call that rubidium. And the second component, which we're going to put a small amount of in the condensate, we're going to call that cesium. And the reason for picking these two species here is because these satisfy this condition over here. And this is the condition for immiscibility. So this means that when we put a small amount of cesium atoms into our majority rubidium condensate, they're immiscible, so they don't want to mix with each other. So we can now have a configuration where we have cesium atoms sat in this big reservoir of rubidium atoms. But what we're actually interested in asking is what happens when we add some cesium atoms to our vortex, which is in our rubidium condensate. So here we've got our vortex, which is in the rubidium condensate, and then we're adding just a small amount of cesium atoms inside this vortex core region here. So in order to ask this question, we can play the same kind of game that we played before by analyzing the normal modes of the system. And again, for simplicity's sake, we can focus on the case of a doubly quantized vortex. So we've got L equals 2. Again, we're going to analyze the M equals 2 waves in this system. And now instead of varying the trap radius, we're going to vary the amount of cesium atoms that we're putting in the system. So as we move from left to right on this plot, we're adding more and more second component into the core of the vortex. And we're doing this for a fixed trap radius. So here I've picked 40 Heeling lengths. And the reason for this is that it's not small enough that finite size effects that play a very important role, but it's also, no, hang on, wait, that's the wrong way around, I wanted to say that. It's small enough to be able to do numerical simulations of it, but it's not small enough that finite size effects become important. So it's this nice compromise between the two constraints. And that is the healing length of the rubidium, yeah. Yes, it is. Yes, thank you. Yeah, that's a good point. So again, there's two different kinds of modes that we get in this system. We get the phonons, which are in black, and we get the vortex mode, which is in red. As we vary the amount of cesium atoms that we're putting in there, these phonon frequencies are staying essentially constant. And the reason for this is all of this cesium is piling up in the vortex core, which is where the phonons don't live. They live out in the bulk of the condensate. This isn't affected by the presence of cesium, so these phonon frequencies are staying constant. Now, by contrast, this vortex mode is sharply decreasing its frequency here. And the reason for that is that vortex mode lives in the region where we're putting cesium atoms. And again, we get this coupling between the vortex mode and the phonons each time the vortex mode crosses one of the phonon frequencies. And associated with this, we have this instability as indicated by this positive imaginary part. But here we get the first indication that by adding cesium atoms, or by adding a second component rather, the system is becoming more stable, because we can see here that the imaginary part is decreasing in its size, which means that these vortices are going to take a longer and longer time to split up the more cesium atoms we put in there. Now there's another important effect that goes on, which has to do with the energy of these modes. So the energy of the normal modes in the system is just given by the frequency of the modes multiplied by the norm that the mode has. And the vortex mode has a negative norm. So when this mode starts out with positive frequency, it's got a negative norm, which means its energy is going to be negative, and it's going to be associated with a lowering of the total energy of this system. But at some critical value, which I've labeled E to C here, the frequency of this mode becomes negative, so now when we compute the energy of it, it's a negative frequency multiplied by a negative norm, so we now have a positive energy. So this mode is now costing energy to excite rather than lowering the energy of the system. And this means that it's actually energetically unfavorable to excite this mode. So whereas in the case of a one-component condensate, that mode wanted to be excited to lower the energy of the system, we now have to put in energy to excite this mode. And this is going to be what prevents the vortex decay. So in order to verify these, the predictions of this linear analysis, we've got again here some nonlinear simulations of the full system. So the 1, 2, 3, and 4 here correspond to the different points here on this normal mode plot. And we can see that for 1, we expect the largest imaginary part, so we'd expect this one to split up the fastest. Whereas for 4, we get the smallest imaginary part, and we can see that by the time 1 has split up, which it will do in a moment, 4 is basically not split up at all. So we can clearly see here that the stabilizing effect of having a large amount of cesium atoms in the system. Now, the second prediction that we had was that at some critical value, this frequency is going to invert its sign, and it's going to be energetically unfavorable to excite this mode. So we can check that this happens by, again, running some different simulations. So again, 1, 2, 3, and 4 are corresponding to the different points on this graph here. Yep.
I mean, with your parameter of the cesium, you will get, even if there is no vortex in there, a size of the, and you have an harmonic trap, you would get a size of the cesium being trapped inside the rubidium.
Mm.
Now, that will give you a size by a certain number of rubidium atoms, cesium atoms you put in. When that size becomes this, the typical size of the vortex core of angular momentum n.
Mm.
So what? How does all the thing you see relate to that quantity?
I think actually what the question that you're asking is going to relate to something I'm going to show on the next slide. So could I just defer that question?
Because that would be the first question to ask. Yeah.
Yeah. I think I will answer your question on the next slide. Yeah. So just quickly to go before getting to that slide. Just quickly to go through these simulations. For simulations 1 and 2, we're above this critical value where the frequency of the normal mode is positive. So in this case, the vortices are processing around each other in the same way, in the same direction as their rotation. So this is the usual way we'd expect them to process. Now for 3 and 4, for 3, we're very close to this critical value. We're actually slightly to the right of it. In this case, the two vortices are actually rotating around each other in the opposite sense. So this is quite a novel thing that we didn't expect to happen. But because we're so close to E to C here, this precession is happening very slowly. However, for point 4, we're quite a way above this critical value where we've got a reasonably large size for our negative frequency here, in which case this precession in the opposite sense, as dictated by the inversion of this frequency, is now going in the opposite direction, notably quite quickly in this simulation. Okay, so to get to Yorg's point, which also relates to black holes. So we can go back to this black hole superradiance picture and ask, why is this stabilization happening? So this was the picture that we drew for our one component condensate. And effectively, when we're introducing second components into the vortex core, what we're doing in this potential barrier is we're introducing a little lump in that potential here. Now, as we increase the amount of cesium atoms that we put in there, this lump's going to get bigger and bigger. And eventually, what it's going to do is it's going to push that energy lowering mode out of the vortex core. For a critical amount of cesium atoms, there is no energy lowering mode that can live inside the vortex core, which is why we get this stabilization. So related to Yorg's point, once the cesium atoms reach, the size of this helium blob reaches some critical value set by the vortex core, you can no longer support oscillations of the vortex core itself. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so let's move on to some outlook, why I think this is interesting. So it's actually very interesting just from a purely condensed matter perspective. First of all, I think because it potentially provides us with a way of nucleating multiply quantized vortices. So one way of nucleating vortices is to rotate the trap that they're sitting in. And if you do this rotation fast enough, then the lowest energy state in the system is actually a vortex lattice. So what would happen there is you'd rotate your trap and you'd get vortices nucleating in from the boundaries. Now imagine a situation where you've got your majority component sat in the middle of your trap and you've got a small amount of second component sat at the edge of your condensate. So now when you rotate the system, your vortices are going to try and nucleate in from the edge, and they're nucleating precisely in the region that contains the second component. So what could happen here is as you nucleate in a vortex, it could carry in some second component with it. But what all this analysis has shown is that if there's enough second component there, then it's actually a multiply quantized vortex, which is the stable configuration. So this might actually provide a way of nucleating higher winded vortices. The second, quite a natural thing to ask is, all this analysis was done for a tightly confined trap, which is essentially two-dimensional. So what happens if we expand that out and we now have something in 3D? So instead of having vortex points, what we would then have is a vortex filament. And a natural question then to ask is, well, what would happen if we had an uneven distribution of this second component along the vortex filament? So as an extreme example of this, you could ask, what would happen if you had no second component at the lower part of the filament, but you had a large amount of second component at the top of the filament? What would then happen is the bottom of the filament would try split up, but the top of the filament would be bound together, essentially glued by the second component. And furthermore, it would try rotate in the opposite sense, which would presumably lead to some kind of vortex reconnections. So we're not totally sure what would happen in this case, but I think it's safe to say that it would be very interesting to look at what would happen in three dimensions here. So for analog gravity, what are the applications of this? So I think perhaps the most immediate consequence is it provides a way of stabilizing your vortices so that you can then look at wave scattering phenomena around them. So in analog gravity, we're usually interested in thinking about superradiance or black hole ring down or something. But if you've got a large quantum vortex, then that would actually want to split up. So if you want to study scattering processes in these higher winded systems, then you could stabilize them by putting a second component inside the vortex cores. Now you might reasonably ask, well, why couldn't I just do that with my external trapping potential? This potential barrier picture here, which was stabilizing the vortex, essentially only relied on there being another lump in this potential barrier seen by the waves, which then forces out this vortex mode. And you could just put this this bump in the effective potential barrier by putting a bump in the center of your external trapping potential. Now, the reason that I think it's more interesting with the second component is that this, this bump in the effective potential barrier now becomes a dynamical degree of freedom if you've got a second component there. This is something that the waves can interact with, and it can and they can change, and they can lead to interesting dynamical processes. What kind of things could we simulate with this? Well, if this blob of second component atoms is itself a dynamical degree of freedom, then it could have oscillations. So a natural question there that emerges is, could we kind of simulate some aspects of neutron star oscillations? And within this picture, we could ask, how do these neutron star oscillations back react on the effective metric seen by phonons outside? And finally, I think the most tantalizing question to ask is, could we use a system like this to mimic a black hole binary merger in the laboratory? We've seen from this analysis that the system with a second component in it doesn't want to stay as two separate vortices, they want to merge together. So a natural question to ask is, could we find some regime where these separate vortices merge together by emitting some phonons? And we could then ask if the waveform of these phonons in some regimes corresponds to the ones that are seen, for example, by LIGO and Virgo. So that's actually everything I wanted to say. These are the references that I put up at the beginning. These two are the earlier ones for the one component case, and then this is the new one for the two component case. Thank you everyone for listening, and are there any questions?
Wonderful, thank you Sam for that talk. Let's see, okay, we've got a few questions over here.
Thank you Sam, very nice talk. I'm wondering, so if you have the stable configuration of double quantized vortex, you were showing the simulations, there was still some mode that was kind of trying to escape and maybe got reflected by the potential. That was actually quite interesting to look at. Yeah, and I
was this the one you're thinking of?
Number four.
Yeah. So I think this is, so the way that we've set up these simulations is to seed the background vortex configuration with the normal mode, which corresponds to the splitting that we want. But in order to get a large separation, we insert a very large amplitude for this normal mode. So it's really in the nonlinear regime there. And because of this, when you set things going, you get this shockwave off the initial configuration that you set up. And then this shockwave, because there's no dissipation in these simulations, this will just bounce backwards and forwards. If there were dissipation, that shockwave would die out. But then because this vortex splitting is a higher energy configuration, the dissipation would act on that and it would push the vortices back together again, which is what we saw in one of the first simulations.
Amazing, thank you.
That's right. Thanks for a very nice talk. So I also had a question about, I guess, these simulations. So you're talking at the end about the binary black hole mergers and can you see things merging. Is this not the end result of that? So if you started, instead of seeding with the normal mode, you started with vortices further apart,
yeah,
that were spiraling around each other, right? They'll radiate sound waves and slowly lose
energy. That's what I think, but the first simulation that I showed, like on one of the first slides, there was dissipation there, which is what drove them together. Mm-hmm. I would expect there would be some regime where you could start with two vortices, lots of second component in each, and they would want to radiate sound waves and then merge together. But we don't have a simulation yet for that. That would be what I expect to happen. But
okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. If I can have one more little question. So in the previous case with no second component, you found that the actual modes that go unstable is sensitive to the size of the trap,
yes,
that you're using.
Yeah.
Have you looked at what happens? Is there some sensitivity here to the trap size?
Yeah, it's exactly the same. So, I mean, that normal mode plot, as you... if we change the 40 Heedling lengths to 30 Heedling lengths or something, the phonons would become more sparsely separated. That would change the size of those imaginary parts. Here we're looking at a doubly quantized vortex, so the only unstable mode is m equals 2, which is the pair splitting. With triply quantized, you could have a triangle, which would be m equals 3, a line, which would be m equals 2, and you know you can play this game for the higher winding number. So there you've got some room to play with the size of these imaginary parts And for some trap sizes, it might be that m equals 3 is more unstable than m equals 2.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
When you were talking about the single component case, did I hear correctly you said there was a zero energy mode in the core?
Yes. No, so, okay. The core mode has a negative energy, and the phonons have a positive energy. For some trap sizes, these two modes combine to make a single mode, and there the negative energy part balances the positive energy outside to make a total mode, a mode which has total zero energy. Does that...
I'm just wondering if there's a connection to Majorana physics, where you have localized zero energy modes, and it's a result of topology.
I'm not.
So you have a very localized edge mode, in this case, in the core.
Okay.
That's not all you need, but it sounds very...
Okay.
You certainly have topology in here.
I don't know enough about that to comment on it, but I'd be interested in talking to you afterwards. Oh. There's a question.
Oh, yeah, so York has a question? Oh, no, sorry.
Yeah,
oh.
I'd add another question. So when you put your second condensate in, I would expect there's going to be some interaction between the possible phonon states inside the second condensate and the ones that are in the vortex and the ones that are outside.
Yeah.
And I've not seen them in your calculation because usually, you know, I would expect that there is going to be, transfer of excitations
into
the other part and something like that. Then that could change your physics completely.
Yeah, I agree.
That you simulate.
So you can already see in these plots that are shown here, these are all of the normal modes within this frequency range. There's only one mode in the core, and all the rest
but
of them
that
are
in the bulk.
But that's
a mode in the rubidium and not in the cesium, right?
These are the normal modes for the coupled system.
I would not trust the picture that you draw, that you draw the modes only in the rubidium. That's not correct. The modes would also live in the cesium and in the rubidium.
But what I think is happening here is those modes which are really associated with just oscillations of the cesium will be, probably because the core is very small in size, will be at much higher frequencies and won't interact with this vortex core.
But there will be combined modes.
These are also the combined modes. These aren't just... These are coupled oscillations of cesium and rubidium. So here we're solving those equations.
Yeah, but then it doesn't... Then it's not right that this mode only lives in rubidium like you draw it. It lives in both.
It does live in both, yeah.
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 So the drawing that you showed, was it not the correct one with your hand drawing? Because in hand drawing,
which
you only
drawing?
Showed it to...
This one, you mean?
Yeah, this is okay, but, you know, if you then have cesium in there, this vortex mode also goes all the way in. Because it also lives in a cesium.
Yes.
It doesn't care if there's a boundary.
Yes, I agree.
You know, like phonons don't care in any thermodynamic system that you have, phonons don't care about boundaries except if they...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So they would live also in there.
Yeah, I mean, so all these normal modes that I've drawn here, when we solve for them, we look at the mode profiles, that mostly in the rubidium, the majority component, and they induce a small oscillation in the ones of the second component. I assume there will be modes at higher frequencies which have a large oscillation in the cesium component and a minority oscillation in the majority component.
But there will be then a superposition of different mode excitations in the other component. Like we see, I can excite the 10^-4 excitations in the first excited state in my trap, and I see it beautifully in the experiment. And the same thing you would have in the cesium in there too. You would have very small fractions of excitations, one of them, you know, and you would see them, and they would influence your physics.
Okay, I think what I'm saying doesn't go against what you're saying, but maybe we should have a discussion about it afterwards.
And then also there is I don't remember anymore when these papers were, but in the early stages of vortices, there's a beautiful series of papers by Peterevsky and Stringari on the stabilization of vortices by putting something in the core.
Okay.
And that must be in 1998, something like 25 years ago.
Okay. We will...
And there might even be an experiment on that.
Okay.
From Eric Cornell or somebody, or Jean Dalibard. I don't remember anymore. But this was a very strong discussion when the first vortices were made, how to stabilize higher quantized vortices. And the decay of quantized vortices is a beautiful paper of a decay of an n equals two vortex decaying into two, also something like 25 years ago by Ketteler.
Was that in a two-component condensate too, or just in a one-component condensate?
I think there was a... There was in an... If it was two components, it was two spin states.
Okay, but I think the physics is quite different.
Because he made... Yeah, so there's some papers that people thought about some of these things in the very early stages of vortices.
Okay.
And then they thought about it again in the stages when they tried to build the edge states of the quantum Hall effect with vortex matter. Yeah, and there might be some things like... And all of these modes people thought about.
Okay.
But that was 20 years ago or something. And then since it didn't lead to measure to the measurement of the edge mode of the quantum Hall states at that time, you know, it was stopped. But there is now beautiful experiments by Martin Zwirland at MIT. I don't know if they're published yet, where they really see these edge states and these highly quantized vortices and things like that.
Thank you.
Why does the cesium stay in the middle rather than, I mean, and what would happen if you had a cesium dominant component and you seeded the center with rubidium?
So the rubidium's the dominant component. There's a vortex in it.
So there's
this condition here, this immiscibility condition, and I think this is rigorously derived in the case of a homogeneous system, where you ask what happens if I take the rubidium and the cesium to occupy all the same volume, and you analyze the normal modes of the system, and you find that there's this instability which kicks in if this condition is satisfied. And what this instability wants to do is it wants to condense the different species into different regions. So essentially, it's because this condition here means that the two are repulsive. They want to repel away from each other.
Well, to ask the question the other way, what would happen if you had a dominant cesium and then you seeded the center with rubidium?
Oh, I see, if you invert the...
Would the rubidium stay in the center, or would it tend to try to get to the walls?
I think there's no specific property of the two condensates that meant that we chose them that way around. I think the same thing would happen. Jörg's nodding his head, which makes me comfortable because he's an experimentalist. So
if you have an homogeneous system, it's not clear where the cesium is. It will nucleate anywhere.
Right. Okay.
If you have a vortex or something with nucleate in the center.
Yeah.
If you would put that together and have a homogeneous system, it would nucleate anywhere.
Mm.
And then it's a question of how do these nucleation sites find each other.
Mm.
Yeah. And if you have the majority component, will always be around the minority component.
Mm.
Because the equations are symmetric, you know. It doesn't matter where they are. If you look at them, you know, if you exchange, you know, one with two, you don't really know.
Yeah, we take some ratios of certain things. So I imagine that if you swap the two around, you would essentially invert all these ratios. So it would slightly different things would happen. But we check for some other parameters than the ones that I showed in the simulation and saw essentially the same things. So I think you would qualitatively see the same thing.
And then with cesium, you have the advantage you can change the scattering lengths by orders of magnitude.
Yeah, Feshbach resonance and stuff, yeah.
I think in the interest of time, we should probably wrap up here and maybe continue these discussions in the coffee break. So let's thank Sam again.